Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Keith Perron.
Well, hello, friends and listeners, and welcome to another edition of the program. Today, we're going to be talking about shortwave broadcasting from a particular country. Now, many of you, of course, are familiar with Radio Australia. But before Radio Australia, which is Australia's external service, went on the air, shortwave broadcasting was used for domestic purposes. Now, you're talking about a very large country where the population is very scattered about. The majority of the population live in one section of the southeast. But then, in the desert areas and in the northern territories, you do have small communities. So FM wasn't an option, and nor was medium wave. So what do you do? Well, use shortwave. The ABC still does use shortwave. To find out more about its history and also the history of the Shepparton relay used by Radio Australia, we're joined by Nigel Holmes, who was the former frequency manager for RA.
Days of AM radio, we're talking here in the early 1920s and through into the mid-1920s, Australia, like I imagine occurred in North America, we adopted radio very quickly because what did you have before AM broadcasting came along? You would have people anxiously waiting for newspapers to come to them. And people would avidly read newspapers that might be anywhere between a few weeks to a few months old. And, of course, that was news in the true meaning of the word because it gave them information that they hadn't hitherto been aware of. What would you do in the evening? We'd sit around to play a piano. We'd have conversations, things like that. All of a sudden, along comes broadcasting, and you've got the immediacy of news and entertainment in your own house. And so radio was adopted very quickly in Australia. But the problem we had, and it's still a problem today, is that Australia's population is very dispersed across a large country, unlike North America, where you have major population centres from the east coast to the west coast in America and in Canada. In Australia, you have the bulk of the population along a small coastal strip on the east side of the continent, a strip that's maybe 100 or 200 kilometres wide. There's a mountain range, and then west of that you've got desert. Now, in that desert, you do nonetheless have isolated populations who were beyond the range of the 1 or 2 kilowatt medium wave stations, which were the order of the day in the 1920s. So in Australia, the government, through our National Postal Authority, set up investigations into shortwave broadcasting as a means of economically delivering radio to people, as we called it, in the inland and the islands. So we were actually targeting Papua New Guinea and the islands around Australia, as well as the inland of the country. And as I mentioned earlier, a shortwave transmission, once unleashed, is no respecter of boundaries. So our shortwave domestic programming was well received across the Pacific and into Southeast Asia. And, of course, we now move into the 1930s when the world's politics began to evolve and ferment quite rapidly. So these factors led to the consideration of Australia establishing an international radio service. The first shortwave radio broadcasts in Australia were undertaken by a commercial group, AWA, Amalgamated Wireless Australasia, and they in fact ran a station in Apia in Samoa, 2AP. That was a medium wave service. It was run commercially by AWA, and from Sydney and from Melbourne, AWA was undertaking broadcasts on short wave with the experimental call signs, which some of your listeners might recognise as being the same as Australian amateur radio call signs. We had VK2ME in Sydney and VK3ME in Melbourne. And these stations were contracted by the federal government to carry domestic services, Then in the late 1920s, in 1929, the Australian government set up its own service at a site about 20 kilometres outside Melbourne at a station called Lyndhurst, and it was given the call sign VK3LR, LR for Lyndhurst Radio. And that site continued from 1929 through into the late 1980s. Some of your listeners might also recall hearing standard frequency and time signal services from Australia under the call sign VNG, which, contrary to some people's observations, doesn't stand for the voice of Nigel's Garage. They were broadcast from Lyndhurst. And the Lyndhurst site, apart from undertaking experiments into shortwave broadcasting domestically, was also the home of regular domestic shortwave services. So from the 1940s through into the late 1980s, we broadcast two groups of transmissions from Lyndhurst under the call sign VLR, which is a direct descendant of the original VK3LR, and VLH. And those services ran 10 kilowatt transmitters with directional antennas covering all of Australia, and we operated on a full range of frequencies from 6 to 15 megahertz. We use those frequencies, which are normally regarded as international frequencies, because, as I mentioned earlier, to broadcast across Australia, you're looking at distances in excess of 3,000 kilometres. So that means you don't normally use the 2 or 3 or 4 megahertz frequencies. You've got to treat the transmissions in the same way as an international service. So we're looking at lower angle takeoff aerials and frequencies well up into the middle and upper parts of the shortwave spectrum. So we've used shortwave for domestic broadcast in Australia since the mid-1920s. And, Keith, we're still broadcasting on shortwave in Australia to our own domestic audiences in the Northern Territory, where we have three sites at Alice Springs, Catherine and Tennant Creek. Now, each of those services operates as a shower service, NVIS, where we use a 2 megahertz frequency during the night, local night, and a 4.8 or 5 megahertz frequency during the day. And each of those sites covers a radius of 500 kilometres. So just to give you an idea of what we're looking at here in the Northern Territory, we've got three circles, each 1,000 kilometres in diameter, just to cover the Northern Territory with three shortwave services. So shortwave still works when you want to economically cover a large geographical area.
So you mean today, ABC Radio National still uses shortwave to reach domestic audiences in Australia?
Absolutely. That's right. Those ones in the Northern Territory I've just described to you. And the German, the Northern Europeans love our 2 megahertz services. And I've also get reports occasionally from listeners in North America around about 2.3 megahertz. There's not much in the way of other international broadcasters down there. And the three services in Australia operate at 50 kilowatts. So we get quite good reception further afield than just within the top end of Australia.
So Shepparton, then, when Shepparton as a station was created, was it put there for a specific region reason?
That came about towards the end of the 1930s when we realised that the small station at Lyndhurst, equipped with 10 kilowatt transmitters, wasn't able to broadcast into Europe. And at this stage, the writing was on the wall, and the BBC, which had a well-established international shortwave service running certainly 50 kilowatt and I think maybe 100 kilowatt transmitters in the UK, realised that it might be at risk of losing the capacity to broadcast to the British Empire, as it then was. And the BBC World Service, or the UK government, approached the Australian government and suggested that the Australian government might want to establish a high-power international broadcast facility that would be beyond the reach of any warfare, as it was then envisaged. So the seeds were laid down in 1939, and Radio Australia was actually established, came into being on the 20th of December 1939, still using 10 kilowatt transmitters, but the plans were put in, were drawn up to build a high power station at Shepparton. Shepparton was chosen for three reasons. It was beyond the reach of the Axis powers, it had access to reliable electricity, and propagation-wise was a reasonable site for the purpose. So rather than putting the site up in the top end of Australia, I don't know if you've heard of the Brisbane line, Keith. Have you heard of the Brisbane line?
Yes, I have. Yes.
Yes, that was an imaginary line drawn across Australia and going through Brisbane. And if the Japanese forces had invaded Australia, the position was that Australia would withdraw behind the Brisbane line, pretty much the way the Russians withdrew in the face of the Russia of the German onslaught. And then in southern Australia, we'd regroup and re-establish a defensive position and then work northwards from that. And so the positioning of the international broadcast station at Shepparton was part of that thinking.
Well, I mean, we did see historically, I mean, the Japanese did bomb Darwin during the Second World War.
They bombed Darwin, they bombed Broome. The whole lot of the northwest coast of Australia came under attack periodically. There were big naval battles off the northwest shores of Australia. Japanese submarines came down as far south as Sydney Harbour and managed to sink a passenger ferry in Sydney Harbour. And, of course, both the Germans had laid mines. There were sea mines laid in the waters between Australia and New Zealand. The shipping lanes between Australia and Tasmania were comprehensively mined, and there was a lot of activity there to sweep safe passage through those minefields. So, the Second World War did come right round to the other side of the globe. So Shepparton was set up, and it was a major project. If you look at the amount of capital and manpower that was devoted to it, it was clearly a very high priority in the thinking of the government of the day. And of course, it's that legacy that is still with us. We still use that same building. And if you're ever in Australia, Keith, I'll be happy to give you a guided tour of the Shepparton site, because it's quite a museum of World War II industrial architecture. And it's, as I said, it's still in very good working order.
How much of the of what was originally built at Shepparton is still there? I mean, are some of the original antennas there?
Absolutely. Those broadcasts are coming from antenna plant aerials that were built in the early 1940s. There's a group of aerials or antennas that we call the J Group, J for Japan. For obvious reasons, and those aerials again represent an interesting stage in international aerial development. They're single band curtain dipole arrays. They can direct broadcasts up northwards into Papua New Guinea, which is our primary target now, but of course on through into the Philippines and into Japan, and they can be slewed around into an arc from the north to the northwest. So those, I think we have J6, J9, J11, J15, J17, J21. Those aerials are not J6. J6, I think, was built or adapted in the late 1950s, but the other arrays are genuine artifacts from 1942, 1943. Broadcast from Shepparton was mounted on an RCA 50 kilowatt transmitter, which the Australian government bought at a cost of $85,000 in 1942. I saw the invoice for it the other day. that transmitted the first signal from Shepparton on the 4th of May 1944. It was a 15 megahertz frequency, so it would have used the aerial J15. And that was heard by General Douglas MacArthur in the Philippines, in that area there, and he sent a telegram back to the Prime Minister of Australia reporting the high-quality reception and said that it was a great morale-boosting broadcast.
It really is a true testament to good engineering, because if you're talking about transmitters that were antennas that were built over 60 years ago, and you're still using them now, this really is a true testament to excellent engineering.
Again, it's partly environmental. The Shepparton site's a couple of hundred kilometres inland. It's not subject to salt spray or cyclonic winds. The towels were painted with a lead-based paints. Now, we haven't replaced those lead-based paints, but a few years ago we tested the metallurgy of the towels, and it was found to exceed the original design parameters. So they were well installed. They've been well looked after. I think it's just a matter of care and maintenance, and a lot of this plant can last a surprisingly long time. That RCA 50 kilowatt transmitter that I was talking about was in service as late as 1996. So what's that? That's 52 years.
Wow.
Not a bad innings for a transmitter. It used 880 triodes in the output stage, water-cooled triodes. A lot of the components were mechanical components when they were no longer available from RCA. We were able to make them in Shepparton. It's a substantial town and has a lot of engineering capacity and expertise available locally. So even now with the Harris transmitters, the SW100As, and with the aerial switch, the antenna matrix switch on the site, it's no longer supported by its manufacturer, even though it was only installed in the mid-1990s. But we can find enough engineering talent in the town of Shepparton to build any of the components that we need to maintain it. So it's still an economic proposition to maintain. The SW100 transmitters, I think they only contain one type of integrated circuit, which was used in a servo amplifier. The rest of the components are relatively discrete. The big tubes are still manufactured and they can be rebuilt. So these devices can be maintained without too much effort if you've put your mind to it to train staff. In fact, we're finding that the provision of trained staff with experience and an understanding of high power HF transmitters is probably the factor that gives us the most concern about the longevity of a station such as Shepparton.
And I was speaking there with Nigel Holmes, the former frequency manager for Radio Australia. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International.
The Spectrum Monitor is a monthly electronic magazine covering shortwave, amateur radio, scanning, satellites, Wi-Fi, and vintage radio, which is available for any device capable of opening a PDF file. The Spectrum Monitor also covers amateur radio satellites, maritime and military monitoring on shortwave, reviews of receivers, scanners, and software used for shortwave, and more. Annual subscriptions for 12 issues is only $24, with individual monthly issues available for $3 each. If you're already a subscriber, you can renew your subscription by clicking on the Sign Up for 2015 button. MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and PayPal are accepted. For more details, visit our website at www.thespectrummonitor.com.
Hi, my name's Colin Newell, and I'm the editor and creator of DXR.ca. Since the mid-90s, DXR.ca has been the go-to website for timely resources for the DXR, SWL, and broadcast listener. If you're looking for unbiased reviews of the most modern receivers and antennas, or are interested in participating in some of the more lively online forums all about radio, then come on by. DXR.ca, a world band radio website.
I'd just like to take a moment to tell you about a special program that we're working on, and that is about the Prague Spring and what was going on between Radio Prague and Czech Radio, and also stations like Radio Moscow and Soviet Radio, also including stations from the Eastern Bloc. We've been trying to compile a number of clips and speak to people from that era, and we're working on that documentary right now. Here's a little teaser for that program.
This is Radio Prague, Czechoslovakia, broadcasting continuously in English, French, German, and Italian, as well as Czech, and bringing you late news bulletins and reports as we receive them of the situation here in occupied Czechoslovakia. We are transmitting in the 49-meter band on 6.055 megacycles. However, since this frequency is being jammed, please tune us in by turning slightly to the right or left of this position on your radio dial.
Zloba, závisášť, strach a svár, ty ať pominou, ať už pominou. Teď, když tvá ztracená vláda věcí tvých zpět se k tobě navrátí, lidé navrátí.
I beg you to excuse any possible slips of the tongue, but I am translating straight from a slip of a Czech text. According to information of eyewitnesses, the chairman of the Czechoslovak government, Mr. Oldřich Černík, was taken in a Soviet armed transporting vehicle at about 17 hours this afternoon to an unknown destination.
Zloba, závisášť, strach a svár, ty ať pominou, ať už pominou. Teď, když tvá ztracená...
At the moment, we're still trying to compile clips from Czech radio and Soviet radio from that era, from the Prague Spring. If, by chance, you do happen to have any recordings from that era, do let us know. Our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com, mnp@pcjmedia.com. We're also looking for clips from the Voice of America, BBC World Service, and other international broadcasters reporting on the news of the Prague Spring, and that's for a special documentary that we have coming up in a few months from now. We'll give you more details as we get closer to the transmission date. All right. Well, it's now time to turn our attention to propagation and what we can expect and kind of what's been happening over the past week. Here's our propagation editor, Glenn Hauser.
Keith from IPS in Australia, the global HF propagation forecast through November 14th. Normal to fair at low latitudes, poor to fair at middle and high latitudes, with significantly degraded HF conditions. From Space Weather South Africa through November 14th, shortwave fadeouts unlikely, MUF unstable. Magnetic conditions, November 13th, unsettled to active, November 14th, active to minor storms. From Met Office UK through November 15th, solar activity low, geomagnetic field unsettled to active with minor or moderate geomagnetic storm periods likely. From OK1HH of the Czech Propagation Interested Group, the geomagnetic field will be quiet to unsettled on November 13th, 17th, 20th, 23rd, 27th. Quiet to active November 14th, 16th, 26th, December 1st and 2nd. Quiet on November 15th, 22nd and 25th. Mostly quiet November 18th, 19th, 21st, 24th, 28th and 29th. Active to disturbed on November 30th. From SWPC in Boulder, solar activity predominantly low, with a chance of minor to moderate R1 or R2 levels through December 5th. Geomagnetic field unsettled to active November 16th and 17th, with ANK indices peaking at 12 and 4. Minor storm levels likely November 30th and December 1st, ANK indices of 25 and 5. The quietest dates of 5 and 2 should be November 18th to 27th. Solar flux dipping to 100 November 17th and 18th, rising to a peak of 120 on November 28th to 30th. William Hepburn's VHF UHF microwave DX maps show extreme tropospheric ducting around Madagascar to Mozambique through November 16th, and off western and northwestern Australia. Also along the southwestern coast of Mexico, November 15th and 16th.
Thanks a lot, Glenn. And you can check out World of Radio, produced and presented by Glenn Hauser on the various different shortwave stations and frequencies, of course, by going to his website, www.worldofradio.com, where you can get a list of the frequencies, as well as download the program and get his digest that he uploads after the program, which contains information that's not in the show. A lot of useful and interesting information that he does provide on that program. Anyway, before we go, as you know, we're already now in the middle of November. It's amazing how time is flying by. I mean, Christmas is now only a few weeks away, as well as the new year. And a little tradition that we have here on Media Network Plus once a year is to do a program on the lighter side of broadcasting. You know, radio bloopers and unusual radio broadcasts. This year, we're looking for listener participation. Listener participation. And of course, all those that do provide us clips that we will use in the program, if they are used, will be getting a special thank you gift. Now, what exactly are we looking for? We're looking for, number one, radio bloopers. You know the kind of thing when a radio announcer goes on the air and mixes up words, like that, you know, mixes up his words, you know. Also broadcast mistakes, where something was supposed to play and something didn't. Now, I should tell you right now, we're looking for a wide variety of stuff. It doesn't just have to be from 2015. It could be from 2014 or even from 30, 40 years ago. We're looking for a real mixed bag of things. So, if you would like to take part in that program and help us put it together, send us an email and tell us what you have. The email address, of course, is mnp@pcjmedia.com, mnp@pcjmedia.com. Now, there is a deadline. We would like to actually have the material around December the 11th or 12th. So around the 11th or 12th of December, because we're planning to record the show on the 17th. So if you have anything, do send it along our way and leave as many details about you as you wish so we can actually put that together on the program as well. So like I said, a mixture of things. Now, if you are sending a clip, let's say, that does have profanity, don't worry about it, because we will be able to bleep out the words if we remember to. No, we will do that. We, of course, will bleep out the words to make sure that they don't go on the air. So once again, mnp@pcjmedia.com, and we look forward to your contributions. Anyway, on behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well. We're going to end today with a song, not about radio, but about television, that Dinah Washington recorded in 1953, called TV Is the Thing This Year. So, we'll see you next time, 73 and 88, to the ladies.
TV, TV is the thing this year, this year. TV is the thing this year. Radio was great, now it's out of date. TV is the thing this year. Last night I was watching Old Time Mix. My TV broke, I was in a fix. I got on the phone, called my man, said, get here, Dad, as fast as you can, TV.